Okay. Today pretty much marks the point where everyone begins mourning for the Talmidim and Rabbi Akiva. Some started already on the second day of Pesach and became relevant after Yontif, and some start on Rosh Chodesh. The question is, why do we mourn for the students of Rabbi Akiva? Not that it wasn't a tragedy, but there are a lot of tragedies in Jewish history that we don't have special mournings for. I'll give you two examples of things that happened in the time of Chazal that they didn't institute any kind of special mourning, which would seem to be more serious than the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. In the time of Yanai HaMelech, the Gemara says he killed out all the Talmidei Chachamim, all the Sanhedrin. And we don't have a clue when it happened. We don't mourn for them. These were not the students. These were the Sanhedrin. Hordas HaMelech killed out all the Talmidei Chachamim of his generation, except for Bava ben Buta. And because of that, in an act of repentance, he refurbished the second Beis HaMikdash, and that building, the Gemara says, if you never saw the second Beis HaMikdash refurbished by Hordas, you never saw a beautiful building in your life. So he killed out all the Talmidei Chachamim of his generation. And we don't know when that happened, and we don't mourn for them. So why do we mourn for the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva? In most tragedies in Jewish history, we mourn on Tisha B'Av. Even the things that didn't happen on Tisha B'Av, we mourn to put them in the perspective of eternity. So even the Crusades, the destruction of the cities of Shum, Shapira, Vermaisa, Magensa during the Crusades, which we say Avarachamim now during the Sphira, because they were destroyed during the months of Iyar and Sivan, we still mourn for them and say Kinos on Tisha B'Av. The destruction of the city of Nemirov in Gzeros Tach V'Tach, the Chmelnytsky pogroms, happened in Chof Sivan. There is a fast day for Polish Jewry on Chof Sivan, but we say Kinos on Tisha B'Av for it. So why do we have 33 days of mourning for the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva? Why was that tragedy picked out from all the other tragedies of Jewish history to mourn? Let me tell you one idea. Start with another question. We are preparing with our counting of the Omer for the giving of the Torah. Okay. And it is reminiscent of that first year when they were preparing for the actual giving of the Torah. We prepare for our reacceptance of the Torah every year. But that first giving of the Torah, Jewish people prepared for 49 days before they received the Torah. Bechara, what were they preparing? If you're preparing for a course, so usually you have orientation. So they give you a synopsis of the course, maybe even a booklet to go through or the textbook to leaf through. So you have an idea of what the course is. That's how you prepare for it. But what were they preparing? They didn't know what the Torah was. And I'll prove you they didn't know. Because if they knew, what was the Nasa V'Nishma? Big deal. They knew what it was, right? So it must be they didn't know what the Torah was. And they accepted it blindly. So if they didn't know what it was, how do you prepare for something you don't know what it is? One possible answer could be the following. There is a significant difference between Torah and Chochmah. The Gemara says, if somebody tells you that Chochmah exists by the nations of the world, believe me. There are Chachmei Umos Ha'olam, we make a bracha on a Chocham, Chachmei Umos Ha'olam. Asher Nosan Me Chochmosol Abosar V'Dom. You see an extra special genius in secular wisdom, whether he's Jewish or non-Jewish. You make a bracha on him. So Chachma Bagoyim Tam. Somebody tells you that Chachma exists by the nations of the world, believe it. Torah Bagoyim Al Tam. If somebody tells you that Torah exists by the nations of the world, don't believe it. So on the surface, seems difficult to understand. If it means that categorically no Goy learns Torah, they learn secularism, they don't learn Torah. It's not true. There are plenty of goyim who learn Torah. They may not be allowed to do it, but they do it. There are even goyim who learn Gemara. There are even goyim who wrote commentaries on the Mishnah. So that can't be. Elamai, that goyim really can't understand Torah. They learn it, but they don't really understand. It's also not true. I guarantee you that a nuclear physicist can open an art scroll, Chumash, and make heads or tails of it. So, what does it mean, categorically? Torah by goyim altan. So, I think that a possible answer is the following. There is a significant difference between Torah and Chochmah. Chochmah is something a person possesses. It doesn't necessarily have to make an impression on his personal life or character. It can. There are many secular chachomim whose wisdom did make an impression on them, and they were very fine people. But it didn't have to. You can be a great artist, a great poet, a great literary figure, a politician, right, a scientist, and you can be a miserable person. Your character and behavior doesn't take one bit away from your professional wisdom, and your professional wisdom doesn't add one bit to your character. There's no contradiction between them. Right? There have been great politicians who have been, to put it mildly, menuvali. Right? Basically, people who are the dregs of society, but they were great politicians. Secular wisdom does not necessarily have to go together with good character or good behavior. And a person can be an excellent president of the United States and still be a maneuver. Right? Be a nuclear scientist and be a rotten person. The rotten person does not detract from his greatness as a nuclear scientist, and his being a nuclear scientist doesn't add to his personality. Torah can't be like that. Give you an example, like we'd like to quote. Bertram Russell was a professor of ethics in City College in the 1940s. During that period of his life, he was not a very ethical and moral person, according to the standards of society at the time. That's when Goyim still had some kind of standards and values. He was a proponent of free love, didn't believe in marriage. He was a communist, and the ethics committee of the college called him in, and they said, "Professor Russell, we have a problem with you. You occupy the seat of ethics in this university, and you're not ethical." He said, "What's the problem?" He said, 20 years ago, I taught mathematics in a college in England. And I taught geometry. Not once did the ethics committee of that college call me in and say, "Professor Russell, we have a problem with you. You teach geometry in our institution, and you're not a triangle, circle, or parallelogram. I don't have to be what I teach. I just have to teach it. I don't have to be a plane to teach geometry. I don't have to be ethical to teach ethics. I just have to teach it." That's Chochmah. Chochmah is something you possess. It doesn't necessarily have to make an impression on your person or personality or behavior. It can. It doesn't have to. Torah is not like that. The Gemara says that Torah is nimshala ke'esh. Torah is like fire. Ma'esh osaroshe ma'torah. In order for Torah to be Torah, it has to make an impression on you. You can't remain a negative person and be someone who possesses Torah. In one second we'll see that there are people like that. We'll explain it in a second. But in order for it to be Torah, it has to be like fire. It has to make an impression on it. If it doesn't make an impression, then it's not Torah. There are people who seemingly know Torah and doesn't make an impression. There's no connection to their behavior. Giving an extreme example. Somebody you probably maybe have heard of, but I'm not going to mention his name anyway. He lived about 100 years ago in Lithuania. He then eventually moved to America and became a big shot in the conservative movement. He was learning in one of the more famous yeshivas in Lithuania at the time, which I won't mention. That yeshiva had four shiurim, four levels. He was in the fifth level, together with the Rosh Yeshiva's son. They were beyond everybody else in the yeshiva. And he was an ilud, a genius in total. And they had great expectations for him. Until one day, they found him smoking a cigar, writing his Chidushei Torah. It just happened to be Shabbos. So they asked him to leave the yeshiva, and eventually he emigrated to America and became one of the heads of the conservative movement in America. He obviously knew a lot of Torah, knew a tremendous amount of Torah, but we said Torah has to make an impression. So what was it? So I always like to compare it to the following. You go to a wedding sometimes, on the men's side at least, I don't know what they do on the women's side. They have one of the shtick that they do is they have this liquid that they pour in their hat and they light it and it produces a cold flame. It's some kind of alcohol or whatever, and it doesn't burn. It just burns a cool flame. It doesn't burn up the hat. Surely doesn't burn up the person. It does this many chasanas. And it's a way of being the sameach chasan v'kalim. Now that fire looks like fire, smells like fire, sounds like fire, but it's not real fire. It's stage fire. It's fake fire. How do I know? It doesn't burn anything. You can have what appears to be Torah, smells like Torah, sounds like Torah, looks like Torah. But if it doesn't make an impression on the person who's learning it, then it remains Chochmah. Then he's learning Chochmah. It's not Torah. It's stage Torah. It's fake Torah. Looks like Torah. Looks like the real thing, but it's not the real thing. In order for Torah to become Torah and not Chochmah, it has to make an impression on the person who is learning. So, that's the difference between Torah and Chochmah. That's why there's a different bracha that we make on a Torah scholar and a secular scholar. On a secular scholar, I told you, make the bracha, Asher Nosan Mechachmosa Lebosu V'Dom. God gives the wisdom, no strings attached, the person can remain flesh and blood, he has the Chochmah, do what you want with him. By a Torah scholar, it's a different bracha. Asher Cholak Mechachmosa Liyareya. That God apportioned out his wisdom, he shared his wisdom with those that fear him. In order to get Torah wisdom, you have to have fear God, and God doesn't separate himself, he comes along with it. And if he doesn't come along with it, then you may have the same, looks exactly like Torah, but it's not, it remains Chochmah. That's the difference between Torah and Chochmah. And therefore, if somebody tells you that Goyim understand the concept of Chochmah fine, that the concept of Torah, that the knowledge has to make an impression, otherwise not considered knowledge, that they don't get. That doesn't exist by the nations of the world. In any case, that is similar to what Chazal say, that the goal, therefore, of learning Torah is that a person should embody that Torah and it should transform him into a living Sefer Torah. Torah is not education or information, it's transformation. It transforms you into something different. And therefore the Gemara says, Kama tipshoi sharinchi. Many people are very foolish. The Kami mikmi Sefer Torah, they stand up for a Sefer Torah. Sefer Torah comes out of the Aron Kodesh, they jump to their feet. But they don't stand up for a Talmud Chacham. The Sefer Torah is a dead Sefer Torah on dead parchment, locked up in an Aron Kodesh the whole week. Doesn't help anybody, doesn't teach anybody. Right? The whole purpose of that Torah is that a human being should learn it and become a living Sefer Torah. So people stand up for the dead Sefer Torah, don't stand up for the living Sefer Torah. It's foolishness. But that is the goal, to become a living Sefer Torah. And to a certain degree, this is the reason why the majority of the Torah was given orally and not in writing. Why didn't God give us, you know, all the volumes of the art scroll Talmud? God could have given them in writing. Why did he give the Torah where it remained oral? And even today, with all the art scrolls and with all the Steinsaltz, whatever else there is, you still need a Rebbe to teach you Gemara. You can't learn it from a book. Most of what is there is oral. Why? One of the reasons is that you can't curl up with a book and think that you get Torah knowledge by learning information. You have to learn it from somebody who embodies it and represents it. And you can't learn from a Rebbe who doesn't embody the Torah, whose character is at odds with the Torah. If the Rav is like a Malach, then you should learn from it. And if not, not. I just have to say so you don't leave. That doesn't mean that every Rav has to be a Malach, because there are very few Malachim in this world. They're up in Shammai. So, who is fit to teach Torah? It doesn't say, if the person is like a Malach, make him your Rav. If it said that, then it'd be very difficult for anybody to assume such a position of a teacher. It says, if the Rav is like a Malach, meaning, it's hard to be a Malach 24 hours a day, but at least in the time when you're teaching, when you're presenting Torah, there you have to appear to be a Malach. Not that you have to be a faker or a hypocrite, but at least make an effort that when you're teaching the students, you appear to them like a Malach. That has to be. And I found that Sam Sofer says that a Rebbe, when he teaches children, should have when he teaches them Yirah Shamayim Yisera, extra Yirah Shamayim. He should be in Yirah Shamayim all the time. But when he's teaching the children to be an example, he has to have extra Yirah Shamayim. He has to appear to them like a Malach. So in any case, so that is the reason, one of the reasons, why the Torah was given orally. You can't merely get information. You have to get it from somebody who's a living Sefer Torah, so you know that that's the goal. If you want to learn that Torah, you have to eventually be like that person. You have to also be a living Sefer Torah. You have to embody what you learn. And somebody who says, Ein li ela Torah, I only have the knowledge of Torah, right? But I don't have anything more. I'm not interested in putting it into practice. Then he doesn't have Torah. I feel Torah. That's not Torah. That remains Chacham. And it could be that is the intention of what Rabbi Akiva said. Yohatva reyacha kamocha zeklau gogel batorah. What he meant is the following: why is there a mitzvah to love every other Jew like you love yourself? It can't mean that you do for another person exactly what you do for yourself, because that's absurd. I go out and buy a car, I have to buy everybody a car. Right? In fact, the halacha is chayecha kodmi. Not everybody's equal to me, I come first. If I need tzedakah and other people need tzedakah, I give myself first. If I have water to drink and I'm in the desert and somebody else is there with me and I have enough just for me, I don't have to share it with them. So we both should die. I can drink it and live, even though he's going to die. I come first. So in every situation, a person comes first, before other people. So you can't love somebody else equal to you. You come first. What it means is, and how can I love every Jew? There are a lot of Jews that really rub me the wrong way, right? They're just not nice people. They're frum, but their character just rubs me the wrong way, right? They're nudniks. They're very not nice people, even though they may not be doing anything wrong. They're just, I don't know, just their character gets me, right? I'm sure that I'm not the only person like that, right? I'm sure there are other people that are upset by or bothered by other people's personalities that just don't mesh with them, and they when they see those people, they cringe. So how do you love them? You have to reach a kamoch. The answer is, you don't have to love everybody for who they are. You have to love them as Jews. I don't love you necessarily for who you are personally, but you are a fellow Jew. Reyacha the Torah mitzvahs, you have the same Torah mitzvahs that I do. You have a neshama that is pure, right? I may not like your personality, but I have to love about you what we have in common, that we all have a neshama, we all have the same responsibility, we're all part of the same club. That's what I love about you. I don't love you necessarily for who you are per se. So that's called the Ahavta Re'acha Kamocha. So what is it that I love about another Jew? The fact that they are basically a potential Sefer Torah. Because every Jew is a potential Sefer Torah. Every Jew has in him that Neshama Kedosha and the connection to Torah and the responsibility to keep Torah. And if he doesn't throw off that yoke, then I have to respect that and love that in the other person and feel a commonality and affinity to him. So it's also based on this idea that every Jew is a living Sefer Torah. Therefore, in preparing for the Torah, you can prepare for the Torah itself, or you can prepare yourself to be able to receive the Torah. If you don't have the kind of personality, the kind of behavior that the Torah will make an impression on you, but you have a personality that is at odds with the Torah, and you won't be able to embody and internalize the Torah, then you're like asbestos. The Torah, the fire of Torah, will not be able to make an impression on you. So what they were preparing those 49 days was not the knowledge of Torah. They didn't know what the Torah was. But they knew that they had to perfect their characters in order to be the kind of people that when they received the Torah, it could make an impression on them. That the fire could make an impression. They weren't asbestos where they were impervious to the fire of Torah. They were preparing themselves. That is the mitzvah Sfiras HaOmer. That shows us that the main thing of Torah is not the knowledge of Torah. Because they didn't know what the knowledge was. They couldn't be preparing for it. The main thing of Torah is that you are the kind of person that the Torah can make an impression on. So they were preparing themselves. Now let's put this all together. We have the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. What was their problem? Lo nohagu kovid zebozeh. They didn't treat each other with the full measure of respect that was coming to each one. It doesn't say, chas v'shalom, that they treated each other with disrespect. That would have been Noagu Shalobikovit Zeh and Zeh. They acted disrespectfully to each other. It just says Lo Noagu Kovit. They didn't act with respect. Not that they acted with disrespect. That means that they didn't appreciate that each and every one of them were potential Sifrei Torah. They didn't really realize what a Talmud Chacham was. They appreciated the Torah that they possessed, but they didn't appreciate who they were. And they didn't appreciate that in themselves either. Now these Talmidim were supposed to be the torchbearers of Torah Shebaal Peh. They're the ones who are supposed to pass on the oral tradition to the next generation. How do I know? Because the entire Torah Shebaal Peh went through the conduit of Rabbi Akiva. And in the end, he only had 5 students. 24,000 died, and he was remained with 5 new students in his old age, and they became the torchbearers of Torah Shebaal Peh. Right? Reb Meir was with the Mishnah, and Reb Yehuda, the Sifri, and so on. All of the lines of the oral law went through the students of Rabbi Akiva, and all of them traced back to Rabbi Akiva. He was the conduit, the pipeline, the future generation of the Torah Shebaal Peh, Rabbi Akiva, and his students. These 24,000 should have been the conduit, should have gone through 24,000, not through 5. But they didn't appreciate what Torah was. The Torah and the person have to mesh. And therefore they didn't treat each other with the proper respect, not disrespect, but they didn't appreciate that each one of them was a living Sefer Torah. They didn't appreciate about themselves either. They appreciated the knowledge of Torah, but they didn't see how it has to mesh with the person 100%. Now, this was in the middle of Sfiras HaOmer, which is supposed to teach us that the main thing of Torah is not the knowledge, because you can't prepare for the knowledge if you don't know what the Torah is. The main thing is to prepare yourself that the Torah should make an impression on you. And they were the students of Rabbi Akiva, who taught that you have to react kamocha the klal gadol b'Torah, that you have to love every Jew because every Jew is a potential Sefer Torah. So here are the students of Rabbi Akiva who are supposed to be the ones to pass on the oral Torah, and one of the lessons of the oral Torah is that Torah has to make an impression. can't be a book you curl up with and just get information. You have to learn it from a living Sefer Torah. And it was the middle of Sfiras HaOmer. They had the Rebbe teach them the Ahavta Re'echa Kamocha, which also made out this thing. And in the middle of Sfiras HaOmer, they don't appreciate this lesson. Then they're not fit to be the ones to pass on the Torah Sheba'al Peh to future generations. So they had to die. It wasn't that they died as a punishment for what they did. They just were not fit to fulfill the purpose that they were created for. So they died. They no longer were here. So when we mourn for the students of Rabbi Akiva, the lesson they couldn't teach in their life, they taught through their death. By mourning for them, we understand why they died, and we learn from their death what Torah really is all about. So we're not mourning the tragedy of their death. That we may do on Tisha B'Av, with all the other tragedies of Klal Yisrael. But it is an aid in the midst of Sfiras HaOmer. What is one of the hallmarks of Sfiras HaOmer? That you can prepare for the Torah before you know what it is. How do you do that? You prepare yourself to be the kind of person that Torah can make an impression. You prepare your midos. That's why every day we work on a different character trait. We're perfecting ourselves. We're preparing ourselves that we shouldn't be asbestos and be affected. We should be able to be affected by the fire of Torah. So therefore, by mourning the students of Rabbi Akiva, it's not just coincidental that they died during Sfira. It's not just coincidental that it happens to coincide with the days of Sfira's home. But it is a part and parcel of the lesson of Sfiras HaOmer is intensified by understanding why the students of Rabbi Akiva died dafka at this time and what it has to do with the lesson of Sfiras HaOmer. And by learning that lesson from their death, we atone for their death because what they couldn't teach us through their life, they taught us now through their death every generation, every year. So it's a kapara, it's an ilui for their neshama. So the mourning of the Talmidei Rabbi Akiva is not necessarily mourning for the sake of mourning. It's mourning for the sake of strengthening the lesson of Sfiras HaOmer. Yeah.
Right.
Akiva
thought of going on. Couldn't he have done something about it?
I'm sure he tried. I'm sure he taught them. But as great as he was, they were also great. And the complaint against them was commensurate with how great they were, and they weren't able to correct. They were still human beings. And they weren't able to perfect that failing that they had. Okay, next. Yeah.
I'm confused. Are we backwriting history by saying that Sfiras HaOmer links Pesach to Shavuot as a philosophical, spiritual meaning, when the Torah in fact talks about an agricultural act, and much later on, we backwrite history to call it a spiritual thing? So therefore, if you're trying to backwrite it, you're saying that is what the Torah intended, in fact you're changing what the Torah had in mind when it actually wrote it.
Okay, that is not true. Let me prove it to you. But you can say the same thing about Pesach. Did you say that Pesach is purely an agricultural holiday? And connecting it to Yetzias Mitzrayim is backwriting it? Obviously not. But the Torah portrays Pesach many times as Chag HaKatzir. Right? It's an agricultural holiday. It's true. Shavuos is also an agricultural holiday, and Sfiras HaOmer links the barley harvest to the wheat harvest, 100%. The concept is, and same thing with Sukkos. Sukkos, Torah says, is Chag HaSukkos, Basukkos Hoshavti, yet Torah says it's Chag HaAsif. The idea being that you see two out of the three is for sure like that. There's no question. That not only are they agricultural holidays, but those same agricultural holidays are linked with Jewish history. Okay. Why is that? Because the Torah is not just something in the world. It is the blueprint for all of the world. And therefore, everything that happens in the world at any time, in anything, is interrelated. So the same way that we left Mitzrayim, and it was springtime, and spring is a time of rebirth and regeneration, it's not coincidental, because at the same time that the spiritual world was birthing and regenerating, the physical world is doing the same thing. There's a connection. Oh, wow. A connection between the tomb that is not incidental, but is essential. And therefore, Sukkot is also a time when you bring in all your crops or whatever, is Chag HaOsif, is a time also where you appreciate Chazdei Hashem, because a person could think that, you know, I can rely on my my crops or whatever, Kochi Lotzim Yadi, it's a time when a person become haughty. So the Torah, along with that, said, this is the time I want you to remember your roots, that the Sukkot Shoshavti, don't get carried away with yourself when you had nothing and there was no harvest or whatever. I took care of you 40 years in the Midbar. So if you have now, it's because I'm giving it to you, not because you're creating it. So the two things are intermeshed. The Nail are the same thing. Like Shavuos, even though the Torah does not say openly that Shavuos was man not the Torah saying, but we can figure out from what the Torah does give information. Why the Torah didn't mention it openly, there's other reasons. Why the Torah didn't want to openly mention that this is the day the Torah was given. Why it hid the day the Torah was given. But it's obvious that this was the time the Torah was given. So the fact that the Sfiras HaOmer is connected to preparing for the Torah, as well as connected to the agricultural idea, and the agricultural idea meshes with it. One idea of Shansha Prohor says, the barley harvest was mainly for the animal consumption. Barley was mainly an animal food. Wheat is mainly human, for human consumption. When we went free from Egypt, it was our animal side that was free. Meaning, we were ready to eat barley, like an animal, but we weren't ready yet for the refinement of wheat, and making it into flour, and making it into bread, even with chametz, which we bring on Shavuos, Shtei Alechem, which represents the two tablets that were given on Shavuos, according to some. So, the harvest of barley, and being able to eat that, and counting the days till we'll be able to have the harvest of wheat, has a connection to before Torah, freedom without Torah, and freedom with Torah. It's not incidental, it's essential. It's, yeah, the Torah, the world has its order, and the Torah has its order, and they're not two separate things, they're one thing. So all things in the Torah mesh, and all these ideas behind it are not separate ideas. They're all facets of the same thing, because the entire world, physical world, spiritual world, is all one thing. They're not separate things. So therefore, it's not backwriting history, it's just discovering another aspect of the same exact thing, except this is in the physical world, this is its counterpart in the spiritual world. That's the idea. Thank you for asking the question, give me a chance to explain something I probably wouldn't have explained otherwise. The biggest proof that it's true is that two out of the three, you have to say that. So it lends itself that by sure you have to say the same thing. What they didn't do, the Gemara, there's two other sources of what they did or didn't do. One is they didn't share their Torah one with the other. They named Sora the Torah. They didn't, they learned for themselves. It says there were 12,000 pairs of students, which means that each pair stuck with their chavrusa, and they didn't have anything to do with the other ones. They didn't feel and respect the fact that the other one's Torah is important to me, and the other ones felt that your Torah is important to me. They didn't share their Torah one with the other. And another thing is, they didn't spread their Torah to all of Klal Yisrael. The Gemara says that when Rabbi Akiva met up with his final five students, he told them, don't be like my first students, who didn't fill Eretz Yisrael with Torah, they kept it to themselves. You be different, you go out and spread Torah throughout Eretz Yisrael. And you see that was one of the shortcomings of the first 24,000. They didn't spread their Torah to others. So part of lo nohagu kavod, ain't kavod of a Torah, real kavod is Torah. So lo nohagu kavod can mean they didn't spread their kavod, their Torah, one with the other. And that shows a lack of respect. I don't think you're important enough for me to waste my time to share my Torah. Or, I don't respect myself. Lo nagu kovet ze ba ze, not ze lo ze, one to the other. but Zeb Bozhe. They didn't feel that camaraderie, right, that we need each other. Each one thought it's for himself, his little Caruso, whatever, and that is a lack of respect for somebody else, to feel that I can do it on my own, I don't need you. Part of what we say when we give somebody Shalom Aleichem, right, it says that, I don't know exactly where the source is, but everybody quotes this source, that the person who initiates the greeting, Shalom Aleichem, he gets long life. It's a schus for long life, and the Meiri says the reason why it's so important to be the one to initiate the greeting is because it's a sign of humility. Where's humility to say Shalom Aleichem to somebody? The way I understand it is the following. The word Shalom does not mean peace. The word shalom means perfection, shlemus, harmony. Perfection and harmony are only when many, many things work together. You can't, nothing, no one thing in this world can be perfect, except for God. Everything else is only partial. In order to reach perfection, it needs something else. It needs other things. So shalom is the result of things, many things working together in harmony, sometimes even opposite things. Eish and Mayim get together to make Shamayim. That's real shalom. Osa shalom bin Roma. So, when I say to someone, shalom aleichem, what I'm saying is the following. My perfection depends on you. My shlemus, my relationship with God, because God is called shalom, because he brings everything together. He unifies everything because he created everything. So everything unifies under him. So God is the ultimate shalom. That's why he's called shalom. That's why it's not a good idea to have a place and a doormat that has the word shalom on it, because you step on God's name. You're not even allowed to say shalom in a bathhouse or in the bathroom. And you can't even call your friend shalom and use his name in such a situation. So in any case, so that's shalom. So when I say shalom aleichem, I'm saying that my perfection depends on you. That's tremendous humility. I can't do it without you. I need you for my perfection. For my relationship with God depends on you. Shalom aleichem. That explains why the other person doesn't say shalom aleichem. But the answer is aleichem shalom. Okay. One simple idea, which we'll mention, and I'll tell you what fits into what I was telling you. One simple idea they say is the following. Since it says that somebody who initiates this greeting gets long life, and somebody who doesn't respond, okay, is considered a ganav. You're stealing from that other person by not responding to him, and it says you're stealing what you can steal from a poor person, which means really you're stealing your self-respect, which we'll explain in 1 second what that means. So therefore, the rabbis instituted the following. If I say Shalom Aleichem to you, and you answer Shalom Aleichem, and somebody didn't hear me initiate the greeting, but heard you respond, and then they hear me respond, because they didn't hear me initiate it, they're going to think that I didn't respond. So they made it clear who is the initiator and who is the responder. If they hear me saying Shalom Aleichem, they know that I'm initiating. They hear you saying Aleichem Shalom, they know that I already said Shalom Aleichem and you responded. So they're not choshed that I didn't answer. I didn't have to answer. I initiated. You responded. There's another idea. The word Shalom, we said, this is not mine. These are other ideas. I'll tell you my idea in a second. The other idea is even cuter. It says that Shalom is God's name. So you're really not allowed to say God's name in the beginning of a sentence. You're supposed to say the end of the sentence first and then mention God's name. Because maybe you'll mention God's name and something will happen. You'll drop dead in the middle and you ended up saying God's name for no purpose. So it says that you shouldn't say Lashem Korban, right? If you want to dedicate a sacrifice, you don't say Lashem Korban, because you may drop dead after saying Lashem and you won't finish and you'll end up saying God's name for nothing. You should say Korban Lashem. So if you ended up saying God's name, you already said the whole phrase. So over here, how could you say Shalom Aleichem? Shalom is God's name. You should rather say Aleichem Shalom, so you end up with God's name, not start off. But since it says that a person who initiates this greeting is blessed with long life, it's not reasonable to assume he's going to drop dead in the middle between the Shalom and the Aleph. Okay? That's really not long life. Even if he's 130, Rabbi says he's not going to wait another second to take him. So the person who initiates, who has the blessing of long life, can say Shalom Aleichem. The person who responds and doesn't have that blessing has to say Aleichem Shalom. Okay, those are very cute ideas. But what I think is really the idea is the following. I say to you, Shalom Aleichem. My shleimus, my perfection depends on you. If you answer the same thing, so then it's like ping pong. Right? I'm saying, my perfection depends on you. You say, no, my perfection depends on you. It's meaningless. But the other person says the following. You're right. Your perfection depends on me. But Aleichem Shalom, my perfection also depends on you. We depend on each other. If I just throw it back to you, so then it's just, I'm negating what you said. You know, we're both very nice. But if I accept it, and then I respond in a way that says, yes, you're right. Your perfection depends on me, but my perfection depends on you. Then we've, what's it called, said something together that both of us understand that we need each other. For that reason, it says that it's not proper to say shalom, to give this greeting to a woman, a man to a woman. Right? Because you can understand now, it's more than just saying hello. Right, it's saying my perfection depends on you. To say that to a woman who's not your wife is not a real proper thing to do. So therefore, it says that to say that lashon, man to a woman, is not his wife or mother or sister or whatever, is not proper. And therefore, you can understand why what's it called? It's humility. Somebody says shalom aleichem, right? He's being humble, initiating the fact that he's saying that. Yes, my perfection depends on you. That's humility. You can also understand if somebody doesn't respond, what he's stealing from the first person. I admitted I need you, but you say you accepted that, and that's it. Yeah, you need me, but I need you. So what's that person doing? He's stealing from the first person his self-respect. That's what you can steal from a poor person. You can steal his self-respect. Stealing yourself. You admitted that you need me, and I don't admit I need you. Who needs you? Right, so I'm stealing from you your self-respect. That's why you called a gana. How do we get on to this? That could be the idea of why the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. What was lo noha du kovetz zebazeh? It had to do with the fact that they didn't feel that they needed each other. They didn't share their Torah one with the other, nor did they share their Torah with the rest of Klal Yisrael. And that in itself is a lack of respect for someone else, in feeling that we're all in this together and I can't do it on my own. I need you. And my Torah is not complete without you. And your Torah is not complete without me. That's showing the ultimate respect one for the other. If they didn't do that, then that was some lack of respect.
Rather, two people meet. I see you. Why should I say Shalom Alechem, but not Alecha? Why is it the Torah?
Because, according to what I'm saying, it's perfect. Because, first of all, speaking in the royal we is covered, right? In Yiddish, right, you don't say ear, right? You don't say you say in the plural, right? There's a special way of addressing somebody else covered, right? It's called the royal we. You refer to somebody else in the plural rather than the singular chosen covered. That's the real reason. That's Shalom Alecha. But Shalom Aleichem. That's why when you greet your Rebbe, you don't say Shalom Aleichem, it's Shalom Alecha, Rebbe. Because you don't want to say, you're saying Rebbe, so that's the covenant. Now, you don't need to say it in the royal we. But I think another reason is, based on what I said, no two people are perfect either. They also are only in the perspective of the entire society. So I say Shalom Aleichem, meaning I need you as well as everybody else to make me perfect. So it's not just you individually, but it's you as part of everybody else that gives me perfection. That's Shalom Aleichem. That's why it's in the plural. The simple though is that it's a sign of honor to speak in the plural to somebody, not in the singular.
Where
was
all the
family?
Right.
Who can my boy in the singular?
Who said all this stuff before?
who said it before. You can find some of it in the Tamei HaMinhagim. What I said, you won't find it. But where else did I see it? I don't remember. Over years, I saw this here and somewhere else. I admit it's not mine. The ones that are mine, I think are better than the other ones.
What is this Tamei HaMinhagim?
Tamei HaMinhagim is a very fat safer of reasons for Minhagim. It goes through the entire year, entire day, and gives ideas behind various things that we do that that are more or less minhag and not halachas.
Okay.
Yeah.
Men have shlemus and women have their own shlemus.
No. Shlemus. One second. I forgot what I wanted to speak about tonight. I'm not even going to try to remember. The shleimus really is only when men and women are together. Real shleimus is husband and wife. That makes shleimus. Okay? Because women have qualities that men don't have, and men have qualities that women don't have, both physical, spiritual, emotional. There are men's neshamas and women's neshamas. It goes to everything. As we said, everything is intertwined. So just like there are physical differences between men and women, there are spiritual, emotional. Today, most people recognize that. When the feminist movement started, right, so the thing was, men and women are equal. Equal means the same. And whatever a man can do, a woman can do. Whatever a woman can do, a man can do. And there shouldn't be any, you know, why can't I put on tefillin? That's how it spread into Yiddishkeit, and wear a talis and be the chazan and lame, because if a man can do it, then a woman should be able to do it too. Right? It's not fair. Why did God discriminate against women? Don't let them get up 5 o'clock in the morning and have to go to make a minion and put on tefillin or whatever. I know a lot of men would love to change places with any woman who would like to switch places. But in any case, right, they feel, you know, cheated. I tell my seminary students, I said, if you think that's not fair, let me tell you what's really not fair. You think it's not fair that God didn't give you the mitzvah of tefillin. Right? You don't have that expression of being close with God by putting on tefillin or wearing tzitzis or being a chazan. I'll tell you what's really not fair. When I got married, I'm a very fair-minded person. And I wanted to be fair. So I made up with my wife that I would get pregnant half the time and she would get pregnant half the time. Okay? Because really, it's really not fair. Woman has to carry a baby 9 months, and then all the morning sickness and the pain of the delivery and the right. And what does a man do? So he has to make a blue bar Torah for the bris or for the kiddush, right? Gives out cigars, whatever, all the real difficult things. So today, in the modern world, right, that's not fair. So what have they devised? Lamaz. Right? Some of my children did it. That nor the husband shouldn't feel guilty that his wife's going through all this. He's not. So he breathes with her. Right? Right. We're going to breathe together so the husband can feel he's commiserating with his wife, which is absurd. My wife would have rather breathed 1,000 times than go through what she went through with all the children. Right? But that's the way that God made the world. Right? It never happened. She got pregnant all the time. I didn't. I was willing, but they didn't. Rabban Shalom Matzakol didn't make it in the world like that. So there's certain things you can't change. A woman could be a truck driver. She could put on tefillin. She could go to the Kosel HaMaravi and shry on her kishkas on Rosh Chodesh. She wants to be a chazan. But you can't change, like we said, it goes way beyond just spiritual things you can think you can change. There's physical things in this world that it all starts with. And it's all part of the same world. So, real perfection is only when men and women, but that's within marriage, and then there's a society where there are men and women and children, and that's real perfection. So women, yes, have their, what they contribute to perfection of the world, and men have what they contribute to perfection of the world, and it's only when both things are contributed is there perfection of the world.
You said that, Shalom.
Right, but to say to a woman who's not your wife, no, my perfection depends on you, is...
No, wait. What I'm trying to say, man's perfection depends on man.
No. It depends on aleichem, on general, right. Even women.
Ah.
even women. But to say it to any specific woman, right, is really not so new.
Now that you've mentioned it, what do you say?
To a woman? Hi. The word shalom is better not to use, because the Gemara says ain't shalom shalom, except for even what's it called, except for your wife, your mother, or your whatever.
She's accepted.
What do you say?
Yeah.
Rabbi, what
again, I didn't say daughter.
A woman who's got your wife.
Could be, right? There are other halachas also.
Yeah.
Even through her husband, not to say the word shalom. It's better not to use the word shalom. There are, I can't say their opinions, I don't know, but the minhag ha'olam is, yes.
People actually know what you just said.
Okay.
So therefore, if they don't.
Well, now, a few more. The it could be that since the world, the minhag of the world is the yes. Why? Because society has changed, and therefore the halacha is also, ein mishtamshim be'ishim. Right? The women shouldn't get wind of this because it could make a revolution. Really, women should not serve a meal. The men should be serving. And the women should be sitting pretty and enjoying. They can make the meal. But they shouldn't be the ones to serve the guests the meal. Because any stamshin be isha. Because it's not so new for them to serve men. So they should be sitting and eating, and the men should be serving the meal. However, we don't do that. Right? Because it used to be that women basically did not have an active part in society. They weren't involved in business, they weren't involved in social whatever, they were basically home. So if somebody had a contact with somebody, a woman who's not his wife, it was something that was unusual. And because it was unusual, it wasn't modest. But today, the way that society is, even the Goyish society, right, is it's accepted that women are in business and women are in commerce and women are in social life or whatever. So it's not out of the ordinary for a woman to serve a meal, because in all the other areas it's, and therefore, not that the halacha changed, but the halacha was based on what was the custom, and when the custom changed, then the halacha is no longer applicable.
Did that also go for the Sulbash?
Okay, what?
Did that also go for the Sulbash?
That goes for the Shalom also.
Yeah.
The Sulbash? The Sulbash, yes, to a certain degree, yeah. Because then it's not a Beged Isha. Or a Begadish. If all men start wearing earrings, then earrings are not a feminine thing. But if most people who wear earrings are women, and only the exception, if you see somebody with earrings, right away you want to know what she's wearing with earrings, a man, then it's no good. But if it's acceptable in that place, then really there's nothing wrong halachically. It may be wrong for other reasons. Maybe what the earring represents may be a problem. But they used to wear nose rings too. Today, somebody wears a nose ring, you know that something's wrong, right? Or they're a cow or something. What's it called? Right? But if it becomes fashionable and everybody does, it's okay. So it's not that the halacha changed. The halacha is based on the custom of the world, and the custom of the world can change.
Does mashlocha, mashlocha, come under the same thing?
Again, the meaning of the world is not to be mocked on this. Right, since it does say it, and you could greet somebody without saying the word shalom, it's a good idea not to get involved in something that may not be okay. But the minhag ha'olam is to do it, and honestly, most of the time I forget, and also say give regards, whatever, birkat shalom, drishat shalom, habaita, whatever, which probably is better to say drishat, I don't know what, or regards, what? Dash. Yeah,
that's. How do you say hi in Hebrew?
How do you say hi in Hebrew? Hi. with a little, that I learned after coming here that I knew a lot of Hebrew before I knew any Hebrew. All you have to do is put a little accent on it, right? A little accent and it's okay. I really don't remember what I was going to speak about today, but whatever it must have been something. Huh? Manishma? That's okay. Yeah.
It doesn't mean we don't serve the meals tomorrow.
It's a name being Shalom, because my husband's late.